Years of Detachment Lutefisk carried on hacking at the unnatural growth. She stopped to wipe her sweating and sticky face with the back of her glove. The combat nurse's ochre canvas trousers and khaki uniform shirt stuck to her body under her black cloth-covered armor, and her braid of brown hair under her black helmet was a wet rat tail down her back. Green sap covered their uniforms, ran down their faces, and glued their machetes into their gloves. The Huey helicopter that had dropped them in the clearing lifted off behind them, blasting them with gusts of chlorophyll-scented air. "God, I'm going to dehydrate," she said. "It's like being back in Nam." Ex-Army Captain Carl Pipkin stepped up beside her to yank down a massive writhing vine. The big-shouldered blonde man stomped on it with his heavy steel-toed boot. The remains shuddered and went limp. "Wrong color. This don't look like Nam. My mother had a garden every year from the time I can remember. This is the right green for a springtime pea shoot, but it's a million times bigger than it ought to be." A winding tendril from a nearby vine reached for his neck. He hacked it off with a practiced blow and beckoned for Bobby to follow. The rest of the company kept on slicing away at the undergrowth to clear the roadway to a 40-yard diameter. Under their feet was paved tarmac atom with a white stripe down the middle. According to their briefing, the road and most of the surrounding countryside had been completely grown over in the last 4 days, an instant jungle in the Le Sueur Valley of Minnesota. Check, check, and double check on the jungle. They needed to get it cleared wide enough to create a landing zone from which to bring the hostages out, providing the poor SOBs were still alive. The vast, fertile countryside around Blue Earth was famous as a growing area for a giant vegetable-producing corporation. Bobby, and most of the others from Detachment Lutefisk, lived about 30 miles east in the Twin Cities and their suburbs. She felt another frisson go down her neck. This was the first time they'd been called out on a monster hunt so close to home. Why am I not in a nice hospital somewhere shaking down thermometers instead of pruning a road? Bobby asked herself. But the question had more than one answer, all of them definitive as far as she was concerned. One, doctors were assholes who treated nurses, even army nurses, even nurses with decades more experience than they had, like ignoramuses. Two, patients in the hospitals might be nice, normal human beings, or they might be anti-war protesters who felt smug about spitting in the faces of returning servicemen and support staff, most of whom had no goddamned choice about going to Vietnam in the first place. Three, MCB paid a whole hell of a lot better than hospitals, or even private care facilities. And God knew they paid head and shoulders above the Veterans Administration for staff. All she had to do was risk her life every time she went out into the field. And four, they basically had no choice. They all had to join MCB. It was better than any of the alternatives, and it gave them someone to talk to about their shared experiences. She felt a chill every time she thought of that first time. The 72nd Mobile Army Surgical Hospital had just been moved into the Dikrong Valley in mid-1972, a stretch of overgrown jungle not unlike the place she was ripping into. The unit was a lot closer to the action than it had been before, meaning that the Army unit that ought to have been backing up the Marines on the front line was split, half helping to keep the Viet Cong from overrunning the camp and slaughtering the patients and medical staff. One bright moonlit night, she'd been on her way back from the latrines when a company of them burst into the camp. At their head was a saffron-robed monk with a shaved head. This was no peaceful Buddhist. His hands were flying around like he was trying to swat a million bugs. Light lanced out from his fingers, and it fed into a spiky, man-shaped thing that grew larger with every bolt. She had been the one to raise the alarm. And somehow they had managed to kill the demon by treating it like a lightning hazard in the camp, something they had experience with. The monk had gotten away. But the real problems started when they were cleaning up, mourning over the messy deaths of several of the medics and the support troops in a literal firefight. A company of MCB agents came out of the jungle, prepared to deal with anyone in the MASH who had seen the demon. They'd been so surprised that the servicemen on the ground had disposed of the monster, they had called off the airstrike that would have taken out any surviving witnesses to the demon's appearance. Instead, they offered the few remaining soldiers and Bobby jobs in the Bureau after their terms of service were over. At first, Bobby had turned them down. Then, when they arrived home, she had to deal with the long-haired draft dodgers who spat at them in the streets of St. Paul. She and all the vets suffered mistreatment from all quarters for going to a war they never supported. She had started a job at St. Paul General, then quit after a month. She made the call, as had most of her unit. The truth was, most of them really liked monster hunting, partly because they never got over the adrenaline rush of being in the war zone. They hated civilian life. They'd been treated badly by the general population, neglected by the government. But they had each other, and someone to shoot at. All but her, of course. Bobby's job description was to stay alive and help the team and any rescuees stay alive, too. If those rescuees weren't too freaked out by their experience, or if they had seen too much of the reported demon, meaning Captain Pipkin was going to have to make a decision on whether to save them or bring them in for hypnosis, or triage them. Her heart sank. She hated it when civilians got into the mess. Worry made her hack faster.
"Incoming!"
shouted Dwight Johansson. The balding former sergeant from Duluth dropped his machete and dragged his M16 around.
"Here comes another bunch!"
He fired off a fusillade of shots at the little round green demons bounding over the top of the hedge. Bobby crouched down and pulled her own M16 off her shoulder just in time. Except for their size, the weird little creatures looked like gigantic green peas, nearly perfect spheres, except for a sharp little beak. On a pea, that was the sprouting edge. These monsters used it to gouge and tear. Poor Helton, laid out on the ground near the perimeter, waiting for a body bag, had his gut split open. Bobby put around into a pea bouncing toward her. It spurted thick green goo like a pimple bursting. Bobby had to fight down her gorge. She looked back over her shoulder.
"Sheena, don't just stand there, do something! This ought to be easy for you!"
The Mashabo gave her a dirty look. The 8-foot brown-furred rabbit spirit, revered by local Native Americans, didn't want to be there since he already had his puff exemption, but the Bureau must have had enough pull to haul him up out of his burrow for this mission. Bobby reached for the pistol at her left hip. The hollow points loaded in it had their tips filled with salt, blessed by a local Ojibwe chief, which she was assured by MCB would keep the unruly demon in line and take him out if he decided to team up with the monster in the valley. On her right hip was a pistol loaded with cartridges that had the bullets filled with acid, blessed by a bishop with magical abilities back in the Twin Cities. That had been an effective weapon against some demons they'd faced. She had to be careful not to get the two confused, but either would have given Sheena a serious psychic burn.
"Lightning and thunder curse you, Bobby Hubert,"
Sheena snarled, showing a couple of front incisors the size of kitchen tiles. He leaped into the air, intercepting two of the green peas. With his powerful paws, he smashed them together into paste and went for another pair. Fragments of vegetation sprayed the whole company. Corporal Tom Worth blasted at another Podsworth that tried to land on the men, chopping at the crazy undergrowth.
"Hubert!"
the captain barked.
"See if you can find anybody!"
Bobby glanced around. The report had said that the commune where Randy Barlow lived was at these coordinates. It took a while to spot the hand-hewn timbers of the cottages under the mass of creepers. The door of one shack stood ajar. With her rifle leveled to protect against the peas, she and a couple of the ex-noncoms, Fred Loftus and Elmo Blanchard, edged through the undergrowth and pushed the creaking portal aside.
"Hello?"
she called.
"Anyone in there?"
A narrow shadow toward the rear of the one-room hut rose, A white man with a long, thin face, decorated with a long, shaggy brown beard and waist-length hair parted in the middle, stared blankly at them. He wore jeans and a chambray work shirt with a long suede vest over it. His face had a patina of grime, as if being close to the earth meant smearing it on himself.
"Damn it to hell," Fred said. "Hippies."
"Shut up," Bobby said. "We've got to get him out of here, too. Excuse me, sir. Do you know Randy Barlow?" The man worked his jaw as if he was going to spit at them. Bobby growled low under her breath.
"Not again."
Then he opened his mouth, shooting a gout of flame toward them. She and the soldiers jumped out of the way just in time.
"That's new," she said.
"Easy, fella. Stand down,"
Fred shouted, leveling his M16 at the skinny man. The hippie bellowed out something incoherent and scrambled for the door, hands outstretched. Bobby jumped out of his way. Fred and Elmo grabbed for his arms. With surprising strength, the hippie threw them off and shoved Elmo into a rickety wall. Fred, who had been trained in karate, twisted the man's wrist and flattened him on the ground. The hippie collapsed on the bare earth, sobbing. Smoke curled from his lips. When he looked up at them again, there seemed to be some intelligence behind his eyes.
"Sir, do you know where you are?" Bobby asked.
"Home," the man said. "Commune.
Oh, God, you've got guns. Don't kill it."
"We're here to protect you,"
Elmo said, his big dark face sincere.
"What's it?"
"The Earth Spirit, man."
The hippie's face filled with wonder.
"The one who made this place burgeon like the Garden of Eden."
"We're looking for Randy Barlow," Bobby said. "His parents are worried about him."
"Stone Singer?"
The hippie frowned and wrinkled his forehead, as though having a couple of men in armor sitting on his back was no big deal. Fred handcuffed him behind his back and hauled him to his feet.
"Last I saw him, he was down by the brook. What's today?"
"Tuesday," Bobby said. "Take us to the brook."
"God, it's all so beautiful, isn't it?"
the man said, ducking under a tomato vine thicker than Bobby's wrist. She shoved greenery out of her face. She couldn't figure out how the hippie, who called himself Appleseed, could tell where he was going. Their compasses were going haywire. The only direction they could see for any distance was up. They threshed blindly in Appleseed's wake. He seemed too out of it to be leading them into a trap, but monsters were cunning. They had enough to deal with from the vines, which kept trying to catch them, but left Appleseed alone. Maybe they thought he was one of them.
"On a smaller scale," Carl said dryly.
He held up a fist. The group halted, weapons at the ready. Carl touched his ear. Everyone listened. But they didn't have to strain to hear. Loud humming like a million bees issued from beyond the wall of greenery. Appleseed started humming in response. Fred flicked him in the arm.
"Wake up."
"Oh, yeah," Appleseed said, blinking. "Just got caught up in it, man. Don't you dig it?"
"What the hell are you and Randy doing here?" Bobby asked.
"We work for the growers," Appleseed said. "We got done with the planting a few weeks ago. They pay us for picking all season long. It keeps us closer to Mother Nature than you robots who live in the city."
"Watch it, pal,"
Elmo snarled.
"I ain't nobody's robot."
"Not trying to ruin your vibes, man," Appleseed said pleasantly.
"What does Randy Barlow need to pick vegetables?" Bobby asked. "His folk records sell millions of copies."
"He doesn't need that green when he's got this, man," Appleseed said.
Bobby knew what the others were thinking. If their target had the rest of the commune under its spell, maybe all of Minnesota was in danger.
"How come another monster moved in here?" Elmo asked. "What happened to the jolly green giant?"
"He's a myth," the hippie said. "We've been chanting, trying to get him to manifest, but this guy turned up instead. He's green, too. Plants just leap up out of the ground for him. We worship him, man. We've got so much to learn from his wisdom."
Don't tell me you're growing those peas we saw back there, Carl exclaimed.
Peas, carrots, string beans, potatoes, everything, Appleseed confirmed, his face a mask of bliss. Bobby blanched. All of them had done the readings on the Green Men of Europe. It was the Brass's guess that this creature was probably related, a demon that gained its power from living things. Even if they couldn't see far, they were moving steadily downhill. Under the humming, the trickle of running water came through. Even louder was the sound of chewing. Bobby spun on her heel to catch Sheena hunkered down over a mass of sprouting shoots, munching away.
Hey! Later!
But I'm hungry,
Sheena complained, opening his big, dark brown eyes and pasting his tall ears back over his skull to look pathetic.
Are you sure this stuff is safe for you to eat? Bobby asked.
What do you care whether a demon gets food poisoning or not?
Fred asked.
Because I do, Bobby said, stung. Some of the stuff they put on crops is worse than Agent Orange.
Hey, we use only organic pesticides and fertilizers, Appleseed protested. Mr. Natural wouldn't have it any other way. We care about the land. You baby killers don't get it.
Bobby grabbed him by the collar of his filthy shirt.
We were exposed to that stuff, freak. We do get it, more than you ever will.
Appleseed recoiled a little.
It's cool, ma'am. Our crops are healthy. Come on, you'll see. Mr. Natural is going to revolutionize organic farming. The future is green, baby.
The humming got louder the deeper in they went. Tomatoes as big as her head hung among frilled leaves longer than her torso. Asparagus half the height of telephone poles poked up through the undergrowth. Bobby felt as though she was in the Vietnam jungle, but a lot weirder. She hated having been scared all the time. None of their other MCB missions had made her feel like she was back there again, and she resented the hell out of it. Carl called a halt again and beckoned. Lutefisk edged up carefully to take a look.
Holy flaming shit, Fred whispered. So that's Mr. Natural.
Bobby pushed aside the greenery and gawked. They had found the source of the humming, all right. In the middle of the fast-moving stream that Appleseed had mentioned, it looked like a tree was growing. The monster stretched green festooned limbs and hair up to the sky. It swayed from side to side as if it could hear music. On the gigantic trunk at its center was a face with glowing green eyes and a wide moss-fringed maw. It did look like the living spirit of nature, if it hadn't taken over a chunk of the state of Minnesota and engendered killer peas. Bobby might even have thought it was beautiful. Around it, dancing and bowing on the banks and right in the water with it, were dozens of long-haired men and women. Mud covered most of their bodies, making it difficult to see if they were wearing clothes or not. Bobby felt disgust. They were abasing themselves before an unnatural creature. Didn't they have any sense or self-respect? Once in a while, they'd breathe fire on the giant. Instead of hurting it, the flames made the huge creature sprout more leaves, and when it burgeoned, the foliage around it got thicker and taller. Other hippies tended to the enormous plants, digging around pods nearly as large as they were.
Damn it,
Elmo said, hacking at the sprouting greens with his machete.
This is probably swallowing our LZ, too. We'll deal with that when we evacuate our target, Carl said. Now, where is he?
In the midst of the happy, chanting group, Bobby spotted their quarry. Randy Barlow was a big man with thick, wavy red hair that he wore in a long braid down his back, like his hero, Willie Nelson. He wore only a pair of much-patched blue jeans. His pale skin had been scorched red by the sun, but he didn't seem to care. He was singing and blowing flames like it was the most ordinary thing in the world.
Down there, Cap, she said. He's your priority, Hubert.
Carl said. The rest of you, 2 teams, 5 and 15. One moves those civilians out of the way and gets them back to the landing strip. As soon as they're clear, Team 2 takes out that giant. When the monster's down, we call for evacuation. And look out for those pods. Got it? 3, 2, 1, go!
Prodding Sheena and Appleseed ahead of her, Bobby stumbled down the slope with Team 1. The whole valley smelled overpoweringly of plants, compost, and fireborn halitosis. Bobby coughed, trying to clear the miasma out of her throat.
See, the humans? They have given their minds over to the giant.
Sheena's squeaky voice was full of scorn.
Shut up, Bobby gritted. Keep between me and the monster. I have to get Barlow out of there.
He's all right, Appleseed said cheerfully. See, he's doing the dance of life.
Bobby edged her way into the circle of dancing hippies. A couple of bare-breasted women joined hands around her and pranced like they were playing London Bridge. Their pupils were pinpoints, probably from the fumes in the air. She took their wrists and tried to pull them apart. They shrieked in fury and shot flames at her. Sheena grabbed her by the back of her armored vest and lifted her out of the literal line of fire. The women's faces softened into idiotic bliss, and they danced away.
There, Sheena said. Do not let yourself be trapped again.
He sounded so smug, Bobby wanted to put a salt plug in his big fluffy tail. Instead, she searched the circle for her quarry. Barlow frolicked at the feet of Mr. Natural, looking happy and carefree. The monster itself seemed pretty benign. In fact, Bobby felt a kind of peaceful vibe in its presence. The closer she got to it, the more relaxed she felt. Why run, she thought. Why not just dance with the others? Her gun was so heavy. A man with long black hair and sharp cheekbones like her maternal grandfather's reached out a hand to her. Why shouldn't she dance with him? She started to put the rifle down. Something heavy hit her in the back. Her temper flaring, she spun to level the gun at her attacker.
That's twice I have saved your life, Sheena said, tapping one massive foot on the ground. And are you grateful? No.
Bobby glowered at him, but he was right. She had to tap the well of anger she carried to keep from becoming one of the hippie freaks in the circle. Concentrating, she homed in on Barlow. He tried to take her hands, but she evaded them and hooked her hand through his arm. He smelled to high heaven, and his clothes were filthy and greasy.
Come on, sir, she said. We've got to get you home.
All of a sudden, the beatific expression changed, and his mouth dropped open like a nutcracker's. Bobby ducked sideways as flames shot out of the folk singer's jaws. Her helmet kept her from getting roasted. All around her, Team 1 was having the same problem with their targets. The hippies wouldn't go quietly. They were fighting and flaming their would-be rescuers all over the valley. But Lutefisk had had one success with Appleseed. Bobby needed to break Mr. Natural's hold over Barlow. As filthy and disgusting as he looked, he was still a human being. As he belted out another stream of fire, she rammed herself up against his chest, hooked a heel behind his foot, and tripped him to the ground. They both fell with a thud. Fire shot into the air like the top of a volcano. Bobby held on tightly as he struggled. In a moment, Barlow went limp and started to sob like a baby.
Come on, you're okay, she said, stroking his face.
Where am I? He asked. It was all so beautiful.
He looked up over her shoulder. The giant had stopped swaying and seemed to be listening. It hummed louder than she had heard it before.
What's that?
That's been holding you hostage for weeks, Bobby said.
Barlow shook his head.
Hostage? No, he's beautiful. He loves us. He cares about us. Oh, God, he's going to eat us.
Barlow threw her off and frantically scrabbled toward the slope. Bobby fell heavily to the earth.
She turned just in time to see a hand formed of gigantic green branches reaching toward her. She rolled out of its way. The fingers fumbled over the ground, trying to close on her.
"Help me!" she called.
The only ones close enough to hear her were three of the hippies. At the sound of her voice, their faces contorted into gorgon masks. They closed in, spewing fire at her. Behind them, Bobby saw Fred leveling his M16 at their backs, ready to kill them to save her.
"No! Don't hurt them!" she shouted. "They're still human!"
The massive hand scraped toward her, dislodging rocks and gravel on the sodden riverbank. Bobby managed to stay away from it, but a fire-breathing woman in a fringe-lined suede mini-dress wasn't so lucky. The branches closed around her and lifted her high into the air. She sang a trill of joy that turned into screams as it brought her up above its mouth and dropped her in. Her cries were immediately silenced. Bobby almost threw up in horror. Most of the hippies were too busy dancing to notice, but a few of them were looking up when it happened. Their pupils widened, and they froze.
"That could happen to you!" Bobby yelled. "Come with me! We have to get away!"
Some of them dithered, but at least a couple snapped out of their trance. They stood, blinking in confusion.
"Get out!" she shouted. "Save yourselves! Hurry!"
Fred and Elmo ran over and urged them up the hill toward the fast-closing corridor in the mass of vines. Bobby was glad to see them escaping. She picked herself up to follow, but she heard more sinister rustling noises behind her. Her voice had drawn the attention of the giant. It came out of the water, hands and even some of its long green hair reaching for her. She tried to climb up onto the shallow bank, but the grass was slippery. She kept falling back.
"Come on, lady!"
Appleseed appeared above her on the bank. He grabbed a stone and threw it at the giant.
"Bug off, man! She's trying to help Stone Singer!"
"Yeah,"
said a black man with a tan vest just barely fastened around a massive barrel chest. He came running down the grassy bank and took Bobby's arm.
"She's good. She wouldn't harm you."
He dragged her over the rise and onto the slope. Bobby banged both knees and one elbow on the way up. Appleseed threw more stones. The giant raised its arms to protect the face on its trunk. With the giant's attention distracted, one hippie after another started waking up from the trance it had put them into. One by one, they stopped breathing fire at the soldiers. Some of them ran away, but others came to form a chain to get Bobby up the hillside with her heavy pack. Barlow was at the top.
"Are you okay, ma'am?" he asked. "I don't know what was going on with that thing, but you snapped me out of it."
"We have to get out of here now," Bobby said, urging him toward the narrowing path. "There are more men up there who will take it out, but we have to get clear. We're going to evacuate you."
"You heard the lady,"
Barlow shouted to his friends.
"This isn't the Eden we made. Come on."
"Stone Singer, I ain't going nowhere with the establishment,"
a woman in ragged blue jeans protested.
"Lena, they're here to help," Appleseed said, gesturing to her. "Come on, we don't have to believe in their politics."
"Well, all right,"
Lena said, but she looked doubtful. They all began to run, with Team One behind them, firing their rifles and grenade launchers. As it lost more and more followers, the giant began to collapse in on itself, screeching like a scalded cat. The pleasant humming turned into a fierce whistle that made Bobby clap her hands over her ears. It stumbled up the hill after them. The hippies fled, pulling Bobby along with them, helping her whenever her heavy boots caught on a root or a rock. Bobby was astonished. These weren't the selfish anti-establishment loafers that she had come to loathe. They were as concerned with her safety as she was with theirs. As Barlow gave her an arm to help her, they heard a ripping noise, like boards being torn by saws. Fred pointed.
"The pods! They're hatching!"
Surrounding the river valley, acres upon acres of pea pods the size of human beings began to split open. From the green sacks, killer peas by the dozen bounded out and began to attack the fleeing people.
Bobby brought her rifle around, potting one huge green sphere after another. Fred and the others loosed off covering fire, backing up the slope. The peas bounded after them. They landed on Fred. He bellowed in pain. Only Sheena's kicks knocked them back. Blood spurted from Fred's shoulder. He'd been gashed right through his armor. Bobby ran to support him, with Appleseed on the other side. "Hold on, Fred," she pleaded, pressing her hand into the wound to try and stop the bleeding. Warm red seeped over her knuckles and into her sleeve.
"I'm sorry, man," Barlow said over and over again. "I'm really sorry."
"Head toward the LZ," Elmo yelled. "We'll be right behind you."
As they plunged into the undergrowth, mortar shells blasted past them. Carl and Team 2 began the destruction of the valley. Their machine gun fire raked the peas, making them explode in bursts of green goo. The giant staggered as it took heavy fire.
"No, don't kill it,"
Barlow pleaded with the captain. "It's a natural creature."
"It's you or it, buddy,"
Carl said with an unsympathetic glare.
"Get out of here so we can save your miserable lives. I'm calling in the airstrike and evac helos. How many locals?"
19,
Elmo said. Carl barked an order into the big black walkie-talkie radio. Team 1 herded the hippies in the direction of the rescue coordinates. Team 2 filled the air with machine gun fire and grenades. Two of the men hauled the 3.5-inch M28-1 bazooka forward and loaded a rocket into it. They could hear the giant only yards behind them. Bobby glanced back. To her horror, it stepped right over the weapons, stomping one of the gunners into the ground. Carl and the others began firing on it. It let out a shriek that rose into the stratosphere and began laying about itself with all of its limbs. Bobby could tell it was getting weaker as more of its human acolytes woke up and smelled the coffee. At 30 feet tall, it was still big enough to cause problems. It wailed in hunger as it threshed knee-high through the mass of vines, raking up yards of jungle with every step. Dwight Johansson leaped into its way with a bazooka on his shoulder. Pete Jenkins loaded in a round. It blasted into the giant's trunk, knocking a burning hole in it. It still kept coming.
"You just made it mad," Elmo shouted. "Dwight, look out!"
Johansson leaped sideways into the undergrowth as the branch fingers reached for him. Unfortunately, one of the hippies was close enough to catch. He yelled for help as the giant scooped him up and deposited him in its maw.
"All organic," Fred quipped.
"You're sick," Bobby said. Hot tears burned their way down her cheeks. The man who died had helped her up when she fell. The roar of helicopter engines was as welcome as a lullaby as the Huey gunships came in from the east. Bobby waved an arm, hoping they could see her through the jungle. No such luck. The pilots took one look at the not-so-jolly green giant lurching toward them and veered off, coming back around with their miniguns roaring. It stood at bay, swinging at the streams of bullets as if they were mosquitoes. Bobby held her breath. The thing had fast reflexes. It almost got one of the birds as it came around again. The black craft lifted just in time. The giant threshed after it, heading straight for the crowd of screaming hippies. Bobby and Team 1 crouched over them, weapons out, hoping they wouldn't be hit by friendly fire from Team 2. From the forest, white, phosphorus mortar shells burst on the tree being's body, the explosion setting some of it ablaze. It bellowed in fury, but fire didn't weaken it. It strengthened it. It grew new leaves and shoots with every new canister that hit.
"Stop!"
Sheena shouted, bounding into the midst of the firefight.
"You are making this harder! Kill it, but do not use fire!"
"We can't," Bobby said. "We weakened it, but it's not enough. It's going to kill us!" The enormous rabbit clicked his tongue.
"And I must rescue you yet again. Oh, well."
He squeezed his eyes and mouth shut and clenched his paws. Bobby watched in amazement as the 8-foot rabbit became 10 feet tall, then 12, then 16. He opened his eyes and grinned down at the nurse.
Now you see why I am honored by the Ojibwe people, he said.
With one leap, he bounded into the giant's path. The tree being windmilled to a halt. It was surprised, but only for a moment. It let out a trilling hum, trying to bring the Meshabo under its spell. For answer, Sheena leaped into the air and scissor-kicked it with his huge feet. It staggered backward, then let out a horrifying roar. The hippies at Bobby's knee wailed in fear. She wished she could cover them with a solid armored dome. Sheena leaped up again and again, kicking at the giant. It retreated a yard or so with every blow, but the rabbit spirit could not seem to knock it over.
It is rooted deeply in the earth, he cried. Destroy the base!
What?
The radio in Fred's pouch crackled to life.
What's he saying?
Bobby grabbed it and pushed the toggle. He's saying, knock the ground out from under it. The helicopters must have gotten the word because all three swung around and came in high. They fired high-explosive rockets into the undergrowth, blowing it into a massive green cloud. Sheena and the giant disappeared. All Bobby could hear was whistling and shrieking and Sheena's war cries and yelps of pain. Within a few minutes, silence fell. The remains of the jungle settled around them into a 3-foot-deep mass of chopped salad. A green haze still hung in the air.
Well, it's too bad, Appleseed said, his expression rueful.
It was paradise while it lasted. I'm gonna miss those 6-foot carrots.
We'd better get moving, Bobby said, reaching for her machete. Let's get out to the county road. Someone will pick us up there.
I can lead us,
Randy Barlow said. The mud had dried on his reddened skin.
Sorry about your rabbit friend. I'll write a song about him and Mr. Natural. Holding back on the rabbit part, of course.
Why?
Sheena asked, appearing through the cloud. He had shrunk down to his normal size. In his paw was a long stick covered with ivy leaves, which he munched on happily. The mist began to clear. Here and there, an enormous branch, one or another of the giant's limbs, stuck up.
Am I not wonderful enough to be honored in song as I am, without Mr. Natural?
You're all right, Bobby cried, beaming at him in relief.
Of course, the Meshabo said, twitching his nose at her. I am the superior fighter. I am far better than any of you puny humans. I knew you would have to use my strength. You are not fast enough or clever enough to deal with a real threat.
Bobby groaned. She couldn't take it any longer. She took the pistol off her left hip and plugged the rabbit spirit one in his 2-foot-wide fluffy tail.
Ow! You're a healer! Why did you do that?
Sheena bellowed, hopping around and batting at the burned spot in his fur. Because you're also more insufferable than any human, Bobby said. I had to. It was the natural thing to do.
All of us got our start in this business somehow. Sometimes you blunder into your first monster, and other times hunters are born into it. And in rare cases, both. A.L. Sons of the Father, Quincy J. Allen.
Mom's gonna kick the shit out of us if she finds out,
Kyle Schaefer hollered over the grumbling dirt bikes. He and his brother were in the middle of breaking the only law laid down by their mother from when they were toddlers. Never go to the Goblin Hills. No reason was ever offered, only the titanium-clad warning. The telltale shadows of goblins reached out to them across the Utah desert. A jagged pattern of dusty arroyos spread out before them, pale sandstone layered with ruddy streaks and dark shadows. Kyle lifted his goggles, settling them over the brim of his helmet. Jared, eldest of the twins, by a couple of minutes, twisted the throttle, the scream of his motor echoing across the hills. As the engine settled into a grumble, he turned with a mischievous grin. Mom can't kick the shit out of us anymore.
Kyle raised a dubious eyebrow.
Not both of us at the same time, anyway.
Jared chuckled, but the doubt in his voice carried the simple truth that their mother probably still had a few tricks up her sleeve. She was that sneaky. And that good.
And besides, he carried on with more bravado, we turn 18 tomorrow. She'd never kick our asses on our birthday.
Maybe,
Kyle muttered.
What's that?
Jared shouted as he revved his engine again.
Nothing.
Kyle put his goggles back on, revved his engine, and let a smile crimp his face. He popped the clutch and wheelied down the rocky slope, leaving his brother in the dust.
Whoop!
Jared shouted and gave chase. Jared drifted his back tire around a massive outcropping of rocks, a boot dragging through the dirt as his engine screamed. A dark SUV loomed dead ahead.
Shit!
He shouted. He jerked the handlebars, rose out of the turn, and angled for a small mound of dirt at full speed. He popped his knees up and yanked on the handlebars as he sailed over the SUV. His back tire skidded across the roof, and then he slammed down on the far side. Grabbing a handful of brake, he came to a wrenching halt, his heart pounding. He turned to see his brother skid around the far side of the SUV, his knee grazing the rear fender.
You okay?
Kyle yelled. Jared nodded with a thumbs up. Then he noticed the SUV. It was a gray Santa Fe, with all the windows shattered. A small, pink, stuffed kitten dangled from the rearview mirror, swaying in the breeze. A weathered Ford Focus sat parked a short distance off, but all its windows were intact.
What the hell?
Kyle asked.
Isn't that Cindy Wilson's Santa Fe? Sure looks like it.
Jared, look.
Kyle pointed past the SUV at what remained of a campsite, dread filling his voice. Three tan tents lay flattened and slashed to pieces. The nylon of one was spattered with droplets and streaks of what could only be dried blood. Clothing and gear lay scattered across the ground.
Jesus,
Kyle whispered. He killed his motor and laid the bike down as he climbed off. Jared followed suit, and they stepped into the campsite.
Oh my God!
Jared kneeled down before a large patch of dried blood soaked into the dusty earth.
It looks like someone gutted an antelope.
Fear filled his voice.
Who is Cindy dating these days?
Kyle asked worriedly as he walked around what remained of the tents.
Ashad something, I think.
Jared rose and lifted the flap of a tent.
You know, that big defensive back from Caneville?
Oh, yeah. I remember him.
Any idea who might have been with them?
No clue.
I don't recognize the Ford back there either.
Kyle stopped in his tracks and groaned.
There's another big patch of blood over here, and a whole bunch of tracks headed off that way.
He pointed toward a maze of narrow, winding canyons to the west.
Who could do something like this?
Jared asked. A wave of nausea washed over him.
The Devil's Dealers, maybe?
Kyle offered doubtfully. It was the only thing he could think of. They'd crossed paths with the biker gang a few times over the years, mostly at their baseball games or a local bar afterward. The bikers, usually drunk, occasionally picked fights with people. The Schaefer brothers always stepped in, and it always ended badly for the bikers, assuming there weren't more than six or seven of them. With their mother's training as well as everything they learned from their father's best friend, Wiley, the two brothers could hold their own against long odds.
This isn't their style. Not by a long shot.
Jared couldn't figure why a low-rent biker gang would slaughter teenagers.
We gotta tell Sheriff Pickett,
What?
Jared asked harshly.
Tell Pickett that we were out here illegally on dirt bikes and we just happened upon a slaughter? After he arrests us, Mom will kick the shit out of us, one at a time, as she bails us out of the pokey. But Jared, we can't just... No, thank you.
Jared crossed his arms as he cut his brother off.
We call Wiley and we sort this out ourselves. If the dealers did this, I see no reason to let them go to jail, let alone keep breathing. Cindy is a friend. Ashad, too.
You serious? Has a heart attack? Jared stepped over to his bike.
I say we go get the four-wheeler, some gear, and our guns. We follow these tracks until we find who did this. We'll call Wiley and he can bring in some heavy artillery if that'll make you feel better, but we'll sort this out the way Dad would have.
Their father had died in the Middle East on some secret mission a few months before they were born. Their mother never spoke about it, but over the years, Wiley gave them enough scraps of information to know their father died a hero. Wiley will take some convincing, but I think I can turn him around.
Wiley, we've got a problem.
Jared sounded nervous, and his brother looked even worse. If Wiley said not to go, they wouldn't have much choice. The brothers talked about their mother kicking their asses, but she never actually had to. Wiley, on the other hand, had been a drill sergeant to them since they were old enough to do front kicks. He was hard as nails and mean as piss when the boys screwed up. And even at 60 years old, the whole town knew he was a BAMF. Wiley was the one who taught them how to think fast, shoot straight, and fight dirty. He demanded their best, and was a real ballbuster any time they came up short.
Jared!
Wiley's graveled voice fluttered in and out across a weak cell signal.
What's wrong? Is Kyle okay?
Kyle's fine. We're both fine.
Jared took a deep breath.
We found a campsite. Somebody tore it to pieces. No bodies, but lots of blood. At least a couple of them are friends of ours. And we found tracks.
Where are you?
Wiley sounded worried. Probably worried about what the boys might do next. Jared started slowly. He gulped, finding that he was more worried about Wiley's reaction than his mother's. Wiley knew all about the Goblin Hills law.
Tell him,
Kyle urged.
We're in the Goblin Hills, Jared blurted. We think the Devil's dealers have stepped up their game or something, and we're going after them.
Silence. Jared waited, nervous that Wiley would fly off the handle, tell them to come home that second and let the police handle it. Even a tongue-lashing from Wiley was a thing to be avoided. Finally, Wiley said the one word Jared didn't expect.
Okay.
The word came through loud and clear, and there was a strange resolve in Wiley's voice, as if something long pent up had finally been set free.
But it wasn't the dealers. Not out there.
Wiley's voice broke up, thick with static. The expression on Jared's face was enigmatic enough for Kyle to poke him and ask,
So what'd he say?
Jared shook his head, held up a silencing finger, and checked his signal. It was down to one flickering bar. He put the phone back to his ear.
Wiley, how do you know it wasn't the dealers?
They're breaking up.
Wiley sounded urgent.
You to hook up the bikes to the four-wheeler, track these fuckers like I taught, arm for bear, know where you're headed. I'm you boys, got your hands. Earth right. Eat you at the entrance. Wait till I get there. Copy that?
Jared did, mostly. Wiley had given them the green light. The pieces he'd picked up also meant he and Wiley thought a lot alike, which gave him a strange sense of validation.
Most of it. Arm for bear, follow the tracks, wait at the entrance.
Jared wondered what the hell Wiley might be talking about.
Whatever that means, he added quietly.
Trust me,
Wiley added, and then ended the call. Jared rubbed his jaw thoughtfully, feeling the thickening stubble that was a relatively new concept to him. There was more going on than he understood, and Wiley's reaction seemed peculiar.
What fucking entrance?
Kyle's face twisted into a knot of confusion.
I have no idea.
Jared slid his phone beneath the motocross armor and into a shirt pocket. He turned and looked at the trailer dirt bikes hooked up to the four-wheeled ATV. He opened the door of their pickup and grabbed his 7mm Browning BAR short track. Quickly checking the load and the safety, he slung it over his shoulder. He pulled out his brother's Remington 750 Woodmaster 30-06 and handed it over. Kyle automatically checked the chamber and safety as Jared walked to the bike trailer and gave it a shove with his boot. All 4 5-gallon gas containers sloshed nearly full in their brackets on the trailer. The cooler, strapped in place with bungee cords, didn't budge, and the old army footlocker with their camping and baseball gear jammed inside barely shifted from where he'd wedged it next to the cooler. They were as ready as they could be. A duffel bag with more of their supplies sat in the back seat of the ATV. Kyle stepped up next to his brother, and the scope of what they were about to do hit them both.
This is some real shit, isn't it?
Kyle asked. Awe, excitement, and nervousness filled his voice.
Yeah.
Jared rubbed the back of his neck again.
You ready?
Kyle nodded.
It's like you said. Cindy, Ashad, they're friends of ours.
There was a trace of scared rabbit in his words, but the resolve propping up each syllable made Jared proud. They'd been trained to handle themselves. They both knew there might be consequences, but facing down whoever took their friends, maybe even killed them, it just felt right.
All right.
Jared looked at his brother. Lean, armed, and armored in white camo motocross gear. His own set was green camo. He couldn't decide if they looked super cool or just plain stupid. Either way, they'd face this together. Like always.
You take the hood. You're a better tracker than I am,
Jared said, getting into the driver's seat of the ATV.
Roger that.
Kyle hopped up onto the plastic hood, clutching his rifle in one hand and holding himself in place with the other. It was awkward, but it put his nose only a couple feet off the ground.
Fire it up!
Jared eased the clutch and sent them rolling slowly over a barren patch of rock.
Don't lose your grip,
he droned.
Yes, Mommy,
Kyle shot back. His nervous laughter sounded hollow in his ears. Jared's did, too. They were headed for trouble, and the stakes were life and death. In the past, it was all spur-of-the-moment, bare-knuckle brawling. This time, they had plenty of time to think about what they were doing. And it really put a kink in their cojones.
Christ! What is that smell?
Kyle covered his nose as they approached a nasty-looking lump of something to the side of the trail they'd followed for nearly 2 miles through twisting canyons. The trail itself wasn't hard to miss. The footprints were a mix of boots, something like moccasins, and the bare feet of a mob of tiny individuals with disturbingly long toenails. Most of the prints were smaller, but there was at least one bruiser in the mix who had to be a staggering giant, either that or a really fat clown. The tracks looked as if Shaquille O'Neal had led a Cub Scout troop on a hike to push landmarks over in the park.
I don't smell any...
Jared's eyes got wide, and he covered his nose.
Holy shit!
As the four-wheeler approached the dark mass, Kyle realized his brother's assessment was accurate. It was shit.
Even with his mouth and nose covered, the stench pressed into him, into his face, into his skin. It clawed at him like hell's version of every beer shit and bloated roadside corpse he'd ever got a whiff of. Part of him wanted to cover his eyes as they rolled by, but the 17-year-old boy in him couldn't tear his eyes away. And then he saw it. Amidst the black mass of what had to be the nastiest pile of shit he'd ever seen, he saw something that chilled his blood.
"Jared?" Kyle called out nervously over the motor. "I don't think these are bikers."
"Yeah?" Jared eyeballed the turd from behind the steering wheel as they rolled by. Jared wanted to believe it had to be the dealers, but his brother's tone sounded like a terrified chummer insisting on a bigger boat.
"Well, who then?" was all he could manage. "Dude, I don't know, but it sure as hell isn't bikers. How can you be so sure?"
Kyle rolled on his side and locked eyes with his brother.
"The dealers don't eat people."
Jared's face froze with shock.
"What?" "There was a fingernail back there, man," Kyle cut in. "Pink. Perfect. Except for the bite taken out of it."
Jared's mouth dropped open. All Kyle could do was nod his head slowly, eyes wide.
"What the fuck?"
Jared whispered. The whole thing seemed unreal.
"You sure you want to do this?"
Kyle asked, clutching his rifle a bit nervously.
"I mean, I'm not sure I want to get eaten today, man."
Kyle was the thoughtful one, looking to the long-term consequences. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that if they got their asses kicked, they were next on the menu. Jared stopped the ATV, cocked his head, and thought about it. His eyes darted back and forth as he pictured Cindy and Ashad and whoever else might still be alive. He and his brother had always protected the other kids, from kindergarten through high school. Every place on Earth has people who think it's okay to prey on the weak. And the Schaefer brothers stepped up time and time again, taking their beatings, but dishing it out twice as hard. It was what their mother had taught them, what Wiley had beaten into them, as if the brothers were carbon steel in a crucible. He turned his gaze to Kyle and held it there.
"It doesn't change a goddamn thing."
At least two of his friends may already be dead. Maybe more.
"These sons of bitches must pay, Kyle."
He looked at his brother, searching for the same resolve he felt within himself.
"You know?"
Slowly, Kyle nodded his head.
"Yeah. Yeah, I know."
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
"You're right."
He sniffed once hard, tightened his jaw, and rolled over onto the hood of the ATV.
"Let's get this party started,"
he called over his shoulder. Jared hit the gas. They rolled down the canyon as fast as they could and still track whatever it was they hunted. And it was a hunt. They rolled around a tight corner, and Kyle held up a closed fist. Jared hit the brakes. The ATV kicked up gravel and small dust clouds that drifted by them. They'd reached a dead-end arroyo, filled with jagged rocks scattered and stacked up in big piles along the canyon floor. Most of the Goblin Hills were weathered sandstone, but this area held a fair amount of hard-angled rubble, much of it darker than the surrounding landscape. It looked as if someone had dug an immense hole in the ground nearby and dumped the tailings straight into the canyon. But there was no hole, only a dead end with high canyon walls. The big cluster of the odd footprints ended right up against a canyon wall. And there was that smell again, somewhere nearby. But neither brother was interested in finding it.
Jared cut the engine, grabbed his rifle, and stood up in the seat, poking through the roll cage. Clutching his own rifle, Kyle rolled off the